One of the biggest COVID-19 outbreaks in America is happening right here in Illinois in the Cook County Jail. We'll talk to a reporter who interviewed a dozen guards, nurses, and detainees about what it's like inside the crisis. Then, black and brown communities have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19 in Illinois. We'll talk about the disconnect between the news media, government officials, and communities of color, and what's being done to change it. And uncertainty about the stay-at-home order and what our new normal might look like has left summer plans up in the air. Today, we'll hear what it might mean for the tradition of summer camp. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. Stay with us, but first, the news. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Illinois continues to report thousands of newly confirmed cases of COVID-19 every day. There were 2,300 more on Monday afternoon, plus an additional 46 deaths. Later on the show, black and brown communities have been disproportionately affected by coronavirus disease. We'll talk about the disconnect between the officials, media, and communities of color, and what's being done to address it. And uncertainty about the future is delaying all kinds of summer plans, not the least of which is summer camp. We'll hear what that might look like for some kids in Illinois. But first, one of the state's biggest COVID-19 outbreaks is afflicting the guards, nurses, and detainees in the Cook County Jail. Reporter Shannon Heffernan with WBEZ Chicago's Criminal Justice Desk has been reporting on the situation inside. Her story was produced as part of ProPublica's local reporting network, and she joins us now. Shannon, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, but before we get into the how the county jail has been in the era of COVID-19, let's take a step back and look at this facility in the before times. What was the Cook County Jail like on a good day before COVID-19?
Right. So Cook County Jail is huge. It's on Chicago's southwest side. It sprawls across about 96 acres. The current population there is over 4,000. And that number is down from where it was at the beginning of March before COVID-19 really hit hard. At that point, the jail population was about 5,600. A lot of the people detained at the jail have mental health issues or other illnesses. They're disproportionately black and brown and disproportionately poor.
I think Sheriff Dart, I've heard him speaking and refer to it as the biggest mental health institution in the country, though not designed that way, right?
Yeah, I think it does have a large portion of people who are living with mental illness. I hesitate sometimes to call it the biggest facility because it implies that treatment is possible in these settings, which I think often it's not the ideal setting for that for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to note that most people who are there are pre-trial. That means they've not been convicted of a crime. Jail is not a place people go because they're being punished. Jail is generally, in most cases, a place people are because they're awaiting trial. So I think that's really important to understand when you're thinking about who's there.
So not long ago, you were on The 21st talking about the State Department of Corrections' One Good Eye policy. And I know you've been reporting on healthcare in correctional institutions for a while now. What is medical care like for people in custody generally and at the Cook County Jail in particular?
So the Illinois Department of Corrections, so that's the state facility, doesn't have a great history when it comes to medical treatment of people in their custody. They've come under federal oversight because their care for people is so poor. At the Cook County Jail, they do have on-site health treatment via Saramac. But you also have to remember that these are places where they're, you know, people are living in really close quarters. It's difficult to social distance. People don't have access to soap, hand sanitizers, or mask. So even in good circumstances where healthcare is being provided, it can be a really difficult place to provide good healthcare to people. I think it's also important to remember that people who are in jails and prisons are more likely to have significant illnesses. And when it comes to prisons, they're also more likely to be older than the general population. So that makes it a population that's particularly vulnerable to COVID-19.
So a couple of months ago, as people begin kind of waking up to the fact that this coronavirus is spreading in American communities, over the following weeks, it really begins to hit jail populations nationwide. And I think you touched on this a little bit, talking about what, you know, the actual living facilities are like. But why are jails and prisons particularly vulnerable to this disease?
I think this is an important point that you're bringing up, Brian. The Marshall Project has been doing a great job of tracking this. They found that there were more than 9,400 cases in prisons across the United States. Once a case gets inside a prison or jail, it really spreads like wildfire. And that's because of those close conditions, right? You can't socially distance when you're behind bars. You have people who are in cells together. You have people handing out food trays between different places. So it's a really hard place to contain any kind of contagious disease. And on top of that, you have the issue with people not having as great of access to sanitation, things like hand sanitizer and soap. So it becomes a real challenge in these facilities, which is one of the reasons you've seen jails and prisons across the United States become hotspots for COVID-19. I also think it's important to note that when there's an outbreak in a prison or a jail, it doesn't necessarily stay inside the prison or jail. You have those staff members going home every day to their communities. You have people from the jails and prisons who get seriously ill going to local hospitals. Often I think people imagine jails and prisons as separate, segregated from everybody, but they are part of our public health fabric. So when there's an outbreak there, it affects more than just jails or prisons.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that point you're making, because a number of the people you interviewed were people who spend, you know, maybe they go to the jail during the day for their job, and then they're home at night with their families, or maybe they don't ever go to the jail. They work in the hospital and just have jail inmates coming in. Well, let's come back to that point in a moment. What moving into the era of COVID-19 now? Do you know what are the current case totals at the county jail for both people who are detained there and people who are working there?
So in terms of people who've tested positive for COVID-19, there's more than 500 people detained at Cook County Jail who've tested positive. That does include people who've recovered from the virus. And there's also more than 300 correctional officers who've been tested positive. That number also includes people who've since recovered. And unfortunately, there's been deaths, 7 total, 6 people detained at the jail and 1 correctional officer. And we've seen in recent court filings from Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart that they expect those numbers to continue to grow.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we're talking to Shannon Heffernan of WBEZ, who's been reporting on the COVID-19 outbreak at the Cook County Jail. So you mentioned about 500 cases. There's the population, I think, this week is 4,000. That's 1 in 8 people in the jail who has either currently or has had COVID-19. Let's talk about some of those individual stories, some of the people you interviewed for your story. The first detainee that you quote is someone who's pregnant. Can you tell me what she had to say?
Right. Her name's Kiana Ford, and she was detained in something called the RTU, which is like the healthcare wing of the prison. So she says that she was there with a lot of women who had illnesses like high blood pressure or taking diabetes medicine, people who would be vulnerable to COVID-19. She talks about when they first heard on the news that COVID-19 was in the jail, how frightened they all were, that some people began to cry, that people were talking about how scared they were and that they really felt that they needed to get out immediately or they were scared they were going to die. She describes the conditions they were living in. She lived in a dorm unit, so there were beds that were very close together. There are large sections of the jail that are these sort of dorm-style units where some of them have bunk beds, some of them have beds that are very close. I should mention that a federal judge has ordered Cook County Sheriff to take action to do more social distancing, so to keep those dorm settings at a lower capacity so it's more possible to spread people out, and that Sheriff Tom Dart has said he's also began keeping people in single cells. But there are still dorm settings that are still open at the jail, but according to the sheriff's filings, there has been more room to social distance since the virus started.
And you mentioned that Kiana Ford was talking about the fear. Was that I guess, right? That's a common reaction among detainees as they're, hearing these news reports.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can imagine watching the news and hearing that you're in one of the top hot spots of the country, how frightening that must be. Some of the detainees we spoke to talked about looking out the window and seeing ambulances drive by. And on Kiana Ford, I mean, I think one thing to notice is that fear is not only about what's happening for you, it's about what's happening for your family on the outside and how difficult it can be to get information. This wasn't in the story, but Kiana Ford has a son who was 13, 14 years old, and he was going between different houses of family members and friends because his mom was detained in the jail. And at a time when we're supposed to be socially isolating and socially distancing, you can imagine how frightening that was for her to have her son jumping between houses and trying to stay in contact with him on the phone and make sure he was safe. So everybody I spoke to, whether they were a correctional officer or a detainee, talked about this fear for themselves inside the jail, but also for people outside and how challenging it was to get good information and stay in touch with people and make sure you were caring for the people that you love.
And you mentioned earlier that, just because an outbreak is happening inside the jail, that doesn't mean it stays confined to the jail. And you talked to a correctional officer who spoke about the practices he was employing when he would go home at night. And I think he even, you say he considered quitting when he got his assignment that he was going to be going into the specific unit of the jail where there were a lot of cases. Can you talk about his story?
Right. So this correctional officer asked us not to use his name, but he actually isn't a correctional officer in his normal day-to-day job. He works for the sheriff's office, but he works someplace that is not the jail. But what's happened as this virus has spread inside the jail and staff have become sick is they've needed reinforcements. And so they've called in people from other parts of the sheriff's department to go inside the jail and work. And he was one of those people who got that call. And he went to an area of the jail where there's been a major outbreak. And when he got assigned there, he was terrified, not only of making himself sick, but of making his kids sick. Since he's been working in the jail, he says he's been living in his basement. He comes into the basement at night, he puts all his clothes in the laundry, and he sleeps down there. I mean, I think it's very similar behavior to what you've seen from a lot of people who are working in emergency rooms and don't want to expose their families. I think that's the level of fear that anybody working inside the jail is living with.
So what has been the official response to this? Let's start with, and we can talk about the staff side and on what the officials say they're doing for staff, but also for the inmates or detainees, I should say. What you mentioned that the population is down quite a bit from where it was. Has that been a concerted effort to try and get people out of there?
So there have been concerted efforts from Cook County officials, including the public defender, the state's attorney, and judges to review people's bail for release. And so that's one reason you see that dropping population. You've also had nonprofits like the Bail Project and the Chicago Community Bond Fund bailing people out. And you've had fewer people who are going to the jail because arrests are down. So all those combined have made for a shrinking jail population. Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, who runs the jail, he's also said that he's taken actions to stop the spread inside. He has said that he's been on top of this from day one and even began preparations in January to make sure that there were sanitation supplies and that there was screening happening. But I will say that his account of what's happened and the account from the staff and detainees, those are very different accounts.
Yeah, he says there's plenty of soap. At one point, you quoted him as saying, if you know, get me the name of somebody who doesn't have soap, I'll deliver it to him myself, or something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing here. And then you sort of juxtapose that in the story with somebody who works in the correctional facility and says, that's a joke. I had to fight to get gloves. I had to call in favors. So the staff, I mean, do they feel that they're being supported in the gear that they need?
Yeah, the staff I've spoken to felt like they were left alone on this. Now, they're not saying that there was never any soap, that there was never any hand sanitizer, that there were never any masks. They say those things were supplied. It was just that they were inconsistent and not always easily accessible. So you see this gap between DART saying, I'm giving these to people, and them saying, yeah, you're giving them to us, but it's not enough, it wasn't soon enough, and it wasn't consistent enough.
So only a couple of minutes left. I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about, I know it can be very challenging to report on correctional institutions. How did you go about reporting this story, finding the people to talk to?
So we talked to over a dozen people who work or are detained inside the jail. We conducted the interviews by phone, and we looked for patterns, things that people were consistent about, that multiple staff members or detainees told us were happening. And then we took those and we sat those side by side with what the sheriff's official accounts were. The sheriff did not agree to an interview for this story, but did provide detailed answers to a list of questions that we sent. And so we put those next to each other and tried to square the accounts of what's happened over the last 2 months.
Yeah, and it kind of reads like an oral history, if people are familiar with that form, as you go through quoting people and juxtaposing it with official accounts. It's quite neat. Last question in about 30 seconds. What is next here? I know there's a lawsuit that's out there. Are cases expected to continue to grow?
So I think that the excellent question. There is a lawsuit, and that lawsuit is trying to force more action inside the Cook County Jail. Judge has already ordered Tom DART to improve sanitation and social distancing. What DART said in a recent court filing that caught my eye is that during the summer months, the number of people in the jail usually goes up because arrests go up. So he says the jail is bracing for that, and that's something that we're going to be watching to see if they can keep some of these social distancing measures in place as the summer goes on.
Shannon Heffernan is a reporter on WBEZ's Criminal Justice Desk. Her story was done in partnership with the ProPublica Local Reporting Network. Shannon, thanks so much for coming back on the 21st.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
You can find a link to her story at our Twitter account. That's 21STShow, at 21STShow. We'll also have it on our website later today. More 21st to come in just a moment. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Grocery stores have been essential businesses during the coronavirus pandemic, and one grocery store and butcher shop in Urbana, El Progreso, has also been providing essential information to the Spanish-speaking community. In addition to updating their customers on items they have in stock, like toilet paper and dry beans, they've also been sharing public health information about social distancing and the stay-at-home order on their Facebook page. Yesterday afternoon, we called Marley Corrado. She manages the store. She started by telling us a bit about what customers can find there.
So we have everything from products that you will find in Mexico, Central America, South America, some European products, some African products, just a variety of different things.
I've heard the paletas are good.
Yes. So we have like fresh ice cream that we get delivered from Indianapolis, which is obviously locally done or 2 hours away, but it's done here. It's delicious. Just different products that people maybe have grown up with that are not necessarily accessible through the big chain supermarkets.
So I understand you've been updating your Facebook page with videos that are in both English and Spanish. What sort of information have you been giving customers?
Just any updates on either our products or what policies we've adapted or even changes that the governor has released out. It just kind of has been a variety of things depending on what we've implemented or questions that we get. When we started to do like the social distancing policies, we did put it up so people would see it and so they would be aware of it once they came into the store. We also did almost like a 411 on what the shutdown meant in Illinois. And there were just different questions on it. So we did essentially a summary of it, both in Spanish and in English, of what it meant and what it meant to the store.
What sort of response have you gotten from the Spanish-speaking community?
The social distancing part of it was, that was strange and completely new to everyone in general, but it was especially to them because we were actually one of the first ones to do it. Even the big chains had not done it. And so when we first started to do it, their response was, why? Why are you doing this? And when you try to explain, hey, this is what's going on, this what is being recommended, a lot of people would even ask. We got questions as far as like, oh, are you guys sick? Or why is it that you're doing this? And so we tried to explain it's for everyone's health and it's for everyone's well-being. And I think it took a little bit for everyone to get adjusted to it. But once I think they saw that other places were doing it as well, they understood why it was being done.
According to the Pew Research Center, concern about the coronavirus is more pronounced among people who are Latino. I think it was about 2/3 of Latinos said that they were very concerned compared to just half of the general population. I wonder if do you get a sense of that among members of the Latino community that visit your store?
Yes. Like once we were done essentially with the shock of it being here, I think people have embraced and have been trying to take care of each other. I think that they are aware of things, and I think a lot of it also comes from restrictions that they've heard and that they know have happened back in their home countries. So restrictions here are nothing compared to essentially restrictions that have happened in other countries that they can come from. And so because of those restrictions that they hear either from relatives or people that they know from, they realize the depth and the length of the gravity of the situation.
Interesting. So it's more they're hearing about relatives or from people in their home countries that it's more severe restrictions in those places.
Correct. So there's certain towns and there's certain areas where literally people are not allowed to leave. So if you are not from that area, you are not allowed to enter or go in or out. There's, for example, in Guatemala, there is a time curfew. You are not allowed to be out after 6. You get fined or put in jail if you are. Elderly are not allowed to be out. And there's certain towns where you are not allowed to go into other towns. Essentially, South and Central America, certain countries have taken this to a different level. And so because they hear this and they see what's happening here, I think that combination has them on alert.
I wonder if you have an opinion about whether it's difficult for people who speak Spanish primarily to get the information that they need here in Illinois, where there are so few Spanish language media outlets.
I think at the very beginning, it was harder. Because it wasn't well communicated at the very beginning. And so at the very beginning, I personally, from what I've seen, saw a lot of resistance to new policies. So for example, the 6 feet social distancing, there was a lot of questioning and not necessarily resistance, but a little bit of resistance and questioning of why that was being done. Now with, let's say, these masks that the governor has now asked us to wear when we're in stores or out in public, now I feel that it's been better delivered. And so the news outlets that are done by the governor, both in Spanish and in English, I think have helped. And I think that there's a lot of community members who've taken it upon themselves to educate and try to inform the public of what is going on. There's a lot of Facebook groups or a lot of text groups where information is shared, and there are trusted community members that share factual information of what the policies or what the changes have been. And because of them, it's been an easier transition, especially, I will say, these last few weeks.
That was Marley Corrado, manager of El Progreso, a grocery store and butcher shop in Urbana-Champaign that specializes in imported foods from South and Central America, talking about providing information on the stay-at-home orders and social distancing guidelines to customers on social media. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. We were talking about the disconnect between black and brown communities in Illinois, and particularly in Chicago, and city officials and the media. And we are joined now, I think, by V. Harrison. She's a journalist with The Tribe, a digital media platform that showcases the stories of black Chicago. V, thanks so much for being here.
I'm so happy to be here. How's everyone doing?
You know, I can't complain. How are you? You were closer
good.
To the epicenter
Sorry
than
about
I am.
I had technical difficulties. I don't know what was going on there, but I'm happy to be here still.
Well, and we are happy to have you. So in your piece for The Tribe about this disconnect between young people in the city and the news media, it's framed around this house party that took place April 25th on the city's west side. Can you tell us a little bit about that party?
Absolutely. So some millennials, young millennials between the ages of 19 and probably early 20s, decided they were going to have a party to memorialize their friends. In doing that, they violated stay-at-home orders by gathering without practicing social distance. And in my article, I had the young lady who was a party attendant, as well as somebody who went live at the party. So her and I chatted about her experience and the fact that they were memorializing a friend at the time.
And when you say memorializing, just to be clear about that, they were memorializing friends who had been lost to gun violence, right?
That's exactly right. They were memorializing friends who had been lost to gun violence.
So what did she tell you about defying the stay-at-home order? Obviously, this drew a lot, you know, because it was live on Facebook and there was a video of it,
sure.
It did draw a lot of online condemnation. What did she have to say?
She did tell me that, you know, she realized that she wasn't social distancing, but she feels like, you know, it was absolutely necessary to meet up. She also felt like Pink Purcell, I'm talking about in my story, also felt that, you know, it's absolutely necessary in her type of a neighborhood in Chicago to get out and get some fresh air, you know. And she quoted something very vividly contrasting people who are richer than her and her peers, basically saying, you know, if I had a basketball court and the celebrities will come bring a basketball court to my home, maybe I can stay home and it'll be easier like it is for them. So a lot of discussion around that specific quote and why her and her friends decided to go to that party that night.
Yeah, I mean, you do hear that sort of thought out there quite a bit that, you know, it's one thing if you're on the Gold Coast in Chicago or in the Loop and you got a fancy building and you got, you know, amenities and things like that. It's another if you're, you know, in just a little less luxurious place to stay, I guess. You asked the person you talked to if she knew about the death rate in Chicago's African-American community, and what was her response to that?
More specifically, I asked Pink Purcell if she realized that Black people were more vulnerable to contract COVID and if she knew that Black people were the highest dying because of COVID. And Pink Purcell told me that she did not know that.
So, I think that gets at what is so interesting about your story. One of the sort of essential points that you were making is that it highlights this disconnect between government officials, news media, and younger Black Chicago residents regarding information on COVID-19. Can you talk about that disconnect?
Absolutely. The disconnect is basically young people having justifications to not trust the news. The way that they're typically seen in the news makes them believe that they don't have a good reflection in the news. So Pink Purcell admitted to me that she does not personally watch the news, that is depressing and usually boring. I had sources in my article like Damate Pongo from MTV, who cited what Pink Purcell said in relation to young people not really seeing themselves in a positive light, which is why they're disengaged, and there's been decades of that. So I really believe that the disconnects really come from the fact that young people are being informed differently, and city officials really need to get down to the bottom of that so that we can better educate the younger Black millennials in Chicago specifically, and so that we can save lives in those communities.
And we've only got about a minute left, but I mean, what, you know, can you talk a little bit more? What are some specific things that you think the city might be able to do to get more people to comply with the stay at home order?
Great question. I think one of the most important things, and Lightfoot has been saying this a lot in her narrative, is that she absolutely needs to meet people where they are. City officials need to absolutely talk a language that young people understand. I do think it's going to take some tough love, to be honest with you. A lot of our young people have some underlying conditions and some deep-rooted mental trauma that I don't think even they're aware of. So we're going to have to get down to that empathetically. We're going to have to heal our young people in a way that then opens their ears, hearts, and minds to understanding the dangers of COVID-19. Specifically in their community. Very important.
And only about 30 seconds left. And you know, actually, if you can hold on, we're gonna take a quick break coming up here. And I'd like to keep talking with you after our break. We're going to change our format a little bit that we were planning for the show today. So I will just say, yeah, if you're just because this is an important conversation, I want to be sure to give it the time that it deserves, despite our minor technical problems earlier. So if you're just joining us, we've been speaking with V. Harrison. She's a journalist with The Tribe, an online media platform in Chicago. Her recent article, A West Side House Party, exposes the disconnect between young Black residents, Chicago officials, and news during the COVID-19 pandemic, came out. That's what we're talking about. We will tweet that. You can follow us at 21STShow. More with our conversation with V. Harrison coming up after this short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about as we've mentioned on previous weeks, Black and brown communities in Illinois are more likely to suffer the negative effects of the coronavirus pandemic. And we've been speaking with V. Harrison, a journalist with The Tribe, which is a Chicago-based digital media outlet, showcases the stories of Black Chicago. And she recently published an article about the disconnect between the city's young Black residents, city officials, and the news media. Just before the break, we were talking about what the city might be able to do to better reach young residents. And I wonder, V, if you can talk about the mayor has been going around and actually, you know, obviously there were the memes, but she has actually been out there. And I saw some reporting from over the weekend where she was like actually, you know, told a group of young people on a playground to go home. And, you know, some of them shouted back at her, "You go home." I mean, can you talk a little bit about, you know, what reception that the city's, you know, efforts have been getting as they have tried to increase communications with the community?
Absolutely. Well, I'd like to think that Lightfoot is listening to the narrative that the Tribe is really trying to publish and get across the city. And that's simply meeting people where they are. She mentioned my article during her press conference on April 29th and said that she found it very insightful. Probably a day after that, we started seeing some reaction and Lightfoot going out into actual neighborhoods like Garfield Park with what you just mentioned, telling a group of kids on a basketball court, go home. I do not believe, honestly, however, that the reception is exactly what Lightfoot wants and city officials are expecting. Again, because young Black people in Chicago are very traumatized due to gun violence that have led to police violence and police brutality against Black and brown communities, I believe that city officials are having a tough time bridging that gap between young people and themselves. I believe that it's also getting very hard for city officials to get through because of this. So I see Lightfoot amping it up. You know, she's going on TikTok, she's doing online graduations. She's really trying to get through to the young people who are most vulnerable during COVID-19, but it's not working. And I really do think there's a disconnect as to why that's happening.
And just briefly, and we've only got maybe a minute or so left here, but you also talk about the media, and this, and we mentioned that earlier, but this is a big part of this disconnect. You know, I don't expect you to solve the problems of how the media has lost young Black Chicago in 30 seconds, but is there anything you think the media could be doing sort of writ large, not the tribe, obviously, but you know, the broader media should be doing to try and, you know, reach people where they are?
Absolutely. I think more faces of people who are impacted need to be in stories. That helps change the narrative. I'm continuing to tell people that 26-year-old Tink Purcell from the west side of Chicago was a very loud voice in my story that happened to go viral 5 days ago. I think it's very important that we tell the narratives of the people that are impacted, that help us better educate them and get their perspectives out there. And I also think it's very important that we treat everyone like this as human as we can, with as much empathy as we can. Everyone has to deal with COVID in their own way, in their own neighborhoods, under their very own circumstances. So I find it very important that the media creates a narrative that allows others across the entire state, across the entire country, create a narrative so that people can empathize and that we can better figure out how to keep one another alive.
V. Harrison is a journalist with The Tribe, an online media platform based in Chicago. V, thanks so much for coming on The 21st today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate being here. Please follow The Tribe, thetribe.com. That's two I's. So The Tribe, TRIIBE.com. Please follow my writing, V.O. Harrison, the new general assignment reporter for The Tribe. And I look forward to changing the narrative in Chicago.
All right. And we will have all those links on our website, 21stshow.org. Thanks again.
That sounds great. Look forward to seeing the show.
Welcome back. I'm Brian Mackey. This is The 21st. Although it might not feel like it after a long March and April, we are officially in May, and the end of the school year is on the horizon. In years past around this time, many parents would be signing their kids up for summer camps. Whether that's a local day camp or sleepaway camp, it's a summer tradition many kids look forward to all year long. But the uncertainty that has accompanied the coronavirus pandemic also brings uncertainty about summer plans and what our new normal might look like in the next few months. For more on this, I am joined now by Sarah Brewer. She's Associate Director of Youth Development for the YMCA of Springfield. Also on the line with me, I have Olivia Ottenfeld. Olivia is the co-director and counselor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's chapter of Camp Kesem. Every summer, that organization offers free sleepaway camps for kids who have been affected by a parent's cancer diagnosis. There are more than 100 chapters at Camp Kesem nationally. Sarah and Olivia, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, I want to start with you. In other years, what kind of different summer camps has the Springfield YMCA offered, and what are you planning to offer this year?
Traditionally, we offer about 7 different types of summer camps. Within the Youth Development Department, which I oversee, we offer 5 camps. They're all traditional day camps, and we also have a program at a campground for our day camps. We have several within our YMCA facilities. And then we also offer a camp for children who have been identified by 186 as homeless or transitioning out of homelessness. Then we have gymnastics camp as well as sports and physical fitness camps. And this year we are waiting to see what's going to happen with the shelter in place, but our hopes are that we're still going to be offering those camps with whatever restrictions or changes we need to have in place to make sure that the children and staff are safe.
But I mean, you are planning to still go ahead with your camps at this point, or are you waiting to hear what's going to happen?
Hope is that we will be able to move forward with our camps. We don't know start dates, of course, but we have not canceled any of our camping programs at this point.
So, Olivia, what about Camp Kesem? I understand the organization has already decided that in-person camp is not going to happened this summer. Can you talk about making that decision?
Yeah, so obviously Camp Kesem is a huge national organization with, you mentioned, over 100 chapters. And it was a very hard decision to come to for them, but we work with an immunocompromised group with parents who have had or have cancer. So our national organization made the change to switching to an all virtual camp. So all of our chapters will be moving to virtual weeks of camp this summer.
So what does a virtual camp look like? Do you know yet, or is that still being worked out?
Yeah, it's definitely still being worked out. I mean, this is super unprecedented. They've obviously never had to deal with something like this, but they're calling it Kesem at Home, and they're kind of trying to make it where these kids that are impacted by their parents' cancer still have that opportunity to like build connections and relationships and still have that outlet of first their self-reflection. So we're hoping to kind of have like Zoom type calls where they can connect with other campers and counselors, but also have activities at home to work on offline on their own time by themselves or with their family.
Yeah, and I guess if the point of the camp is not necessarily the basket weaving and swimming and lanyards and other things that some of us who went to camp finally remember, you can still have that, you know, if your main point is the connection, you can still try and get that virtually.
Exactly. Yeah, and like our goal is the empowerment, the community, the supportive, inclusive opportunity for these kids. And so we're going to try and provide that the best we can virtually.
And Sarah, as the director of youth development for the YMCA in Springfield, what kind of experiences do you hope that kids take away from their Y summer camps?
Some of our key goals each year are character development for the children that we see, learning through play, and just building relationships. And so our hope would be that we're still able to do all of those things while keeping the children safe. And we're currently offering emergency childcare. So we're sort of boots on the ground, getting the experience of what it takes to operate in times like these and function as safely as possible. And we're still having great experiences with the children that we see here every day. We hope to take those same lessons into the camping experience.
How is emergency childcare in an era of pandemic different from what the, you know, what does that look like? Are the kids told to, you know, stay apart from each other, that sort of thing? Or, I mean, yeah.
They are. It's first and foremost lots and lots and lots and lots of cleaning.
Yeah.
And there are some key differences along the lines of we do curbside pickup and drop off. Parents don't ever enter in the building. We create classroom groups so that it's a group of children and staff that don't change through the run of the program. So week to week, the same group of children, it's the same staff working with them just to prevent cross-contamination. And then anytime they're moving through the building or drop-off, pickup, that sort of thing, they're in masks. And when we're doing seated activities, so we have homework time, they eat lunch together, things like that, we intentionally place chairs so that they're, you know, they're spaced apart. And lots and lots of hand washing. So it is a different animal, but at the heart of it, you know, we hope that they're still having a good time and that they're in a nurturing space.
Mm-hmm. So, Olivia, last year around this time, we spoke with a Camp Kesem parent and camper, and I want to play a clip from that conversation and get your reaction. This is Amy Carpentier and her then 10-year-old daughter, Marin.
At school, she doesn't have friends who've been through this. And so having other kids around that she could just talk to about it and who have some basis of relating to what it's like to have a mom who doesn't have hair or a mom who has scan anxiety, as well as just have some time when she's just having fun with other kids.
It feels like kind of like a different than another stay away camp. I feel at Kesem you can actually talk about it and stuff, and it isn't as like weird or awkward, and then other people will understand.
So, Olivia, we can hear the impact, I think, that summer camp can make, especially a camp like Kesem, where kids are sharing such an emotional experience with each other. They can still do some of that sharing virtually, as you said, but I wonder what it means to you and them to lose that in-person aspect of it.
Oh, yeah. When we first heard that we'd be making the shift to virtual, like, it was obviously devastating. This is something counselors and our whole group at University of Illinois, we work for all year long to make this the perfect week for these kids who look forward to this all year round. So obviously, like, at first, it's just, wow, how is this going to happen? How is this going to work? How do we bring the magic, which is something we always kind of focus on. But I think you can even hear in there, like, KESEM is just such a special place with the way that we offer these kids kind of a super unique experience. And one of those things that we usually offer them is our empowerment ceremony, which is usually held midweek. And that's the one opportunity we really give all the campers to speak about the cancer, talk about how they feel at school or with their friends who might not understand. And that's something we're really trying to find the best way to implement into our virtual camp this year.
And Sarah, last question to you, I wonder, and we've only got about a minute left, I should say, but what have you been hearing from parents? Are they anxious to get answers?
They are. They're very anxious. We get emails and requests every day. Are we starting camp? When are we starting camp? And we just really want to be able to provide, you know, that experience they look forward to every summer. We're just waiting like everybody else at this point.
Okay. I guess whatever happens with summer camp, it's going to be different. I want to thank Sarah. Sarah Brewer is the Association, I got the title right this time, Association Director of Youth Development at the YMCA of Springfield. And we've also been speaking with Olivia Ottenfeld, who is a co-director and counselor at the Illinois chapter of Camp KESEM. Sarah and Olivia, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
That is all the time we have for today's show. You can always keep up to date with what we're doing on Twitter. To follow us, just search for 21ST Show. That's 21st Show. We tweet out links with more analysis and background on what we've been talking about. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for providing our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.